From the University of Notre Dame, this is With a Side of Knowledge, the show that invites scholars, makers, and professionals out to brunch for an informal conversation about their work. I'm your host, Ted Fox. And if you'd like to keep up with the show in between episodes, you can find us on Twitter, and now Instagram too. In both spots, we are at With a Side of Pod. Shea Serrano is a staff writer for the sports and pop culture website The Ringer and the author of three New York Times bestsellers, including Basketball and Other Things and The Rap Yearbook. The most recent of the three, Movies and Other Things, came out just last month. So as you might imagine, Shea is in pretty high demand at the moment. And while he didn't have a visit to Notre Dame planned, that didn't stop me from jumping at the chance to invite him to come on the show to talk about the new book, in things like Righting Wrongs at the Oscars, Heath Ledger's portrayal of the Joker, and how kids in 80s movies always seem to be writing things. How this interview came to be is a good story in and of itself, and that's where Shea and I started our phone conversation, swapping the background noise of brunch for the occasional clicking of a turn signal and other sounds of a man on the move. Shea Serrano, I can't believe I get to say this, but welcome to With a Side of Knowledge.
What up, homie?
So your book, Movies and Other Things, comes out in October, hits number one on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. Shortly thereafter, I'm at a Barnes & Noble just outside Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I see all these autographed copies of it there, and I think, all right, cool, I'm definitely buying that today. But then when I open it up, I don't just see your autograph. I see this note that says, "Hi, it's Shea. I wrote this book. If you tag me on Twitter, I'll send you $100. This book is a golden ticket." So I immediately tweeted it at you, and because I have no shame, I said, "Hey, would you come on my podcast instead?" And you being a good dude, said, "Yeah, book it. That's cool. We'll do that." So what's the story on the golden tickets? How many of them are there? Have any of the other ones been found yet? What's going on there?
There are 7 golden tickets in total.
Oh, wow. I feel even more special now.
Yeah. So they printed up, you know, however many, 100,000 copies of the book or something like that. I don't know. So I put 7 notes like that into 7 different books. Each one is like a different money amount. You found the $100 one, which is the lowest.
Oh.
So they go up. They go up from there. But yeah, that's all that it was. I just thought it was like a funny thing to do. Usually they have you, I think I signed like 15,000 copies of the book ahead of time.
Oh man.
And then a couple of other ones afterwards. So sometimes I would just add stuff in there because I was getting bored or I thought it was funny. But yeah, that's all that it was. Just like a little silly thing.
Was it an homage to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at all, or just kind of a thing you wanted to do?
Oh no, it was definitely that. I mean, more than that, it was like an homage to when Michael Scott does it on The Office.
Sure.
I thought that was funnier when he did it because he screwed everything up and it became a whole thing.
Right,
but
right.
Yeah, for sure. The golden ticket idea, that's a Willy Wonka thing.
No, that's awesome. So the way the book is organized, and you talk about this in the introduction to it, in the prologue, saying, you know, this is set up that you don't need to read it chapter by chapter. It's essays about movies and about things having to do with movies. And you do a series of 3 on what you call the brand new Oscars. And you go back and revisit the winners in each of the 6 major categories since 1995 and kind of make some retroactive adjustments. And it starts out with you talking about how you were motivated to do this by the chronic lack of love that rom-coms get at the Academy Awards. And you writing, you know, 3 essays like this about kind of fixing the Oscars, what does that tell us about the Oscars more generally? Are they really set up to recognize the best of fill in the blank, or is there something else going on there? Because it seems like they get it wrong an awful lot.
Yeah, well, you know what? They get it wrong in the sense that they're picking movies that I don't like or that you don't like. That's
right.
All that it is. This is just a group of people picking movies that they like. There's no like real, I don't know, like criteria that go on in there. I mean, slowly they're starting to build that in with like all the Netflix stuff that's been going on. And there are like some actual boxes that need to be checked off. But for the most part, it's just a group of however many like older white people.
Right.
Largely saying, we really liked Crash or whatever. We really liked Green Book. And so I wanted to, you know, I've seen enough of the Oscars to know like they weren't picking the movies that I liked.
Right.
And then I just wanted to fix that. I wanted some of the movies that I like to get some awards because these, I mean, like it or not, these are the most prestigious like movie awards there are to give. This is the movie business's version of like winning an NBA championship is if you can nab one of these awards. What? So, you know, let's hand those out to some stuff that I think deserves it more.
So most of your changes to the Oscar winners are really easy to defend, but you give yourself seven We'll Look the Other Way or WLTOW passes to make seven changes that would be hard to justify, but that you just really want to do. And I think my favorite example was in 1999, taking the best actor from Roberto Benigni for Life is Beautiful and giving it to Blade from Blade because he deserves it for keeping us safe from the vampires, which I think is it's as good a criteria as any. So you're looking at the period from 1995 to today in the book. Do you have any WLTOW changes that immediately come to mind for the Oscars from, say, like 1980 to 1994, that period immediately before what you're looking at?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, I think I mentioned it maybe in passing in there, but I would give a best actor to Jean-Claude Van Damme for Bloodsport.
Right, right.
Like, stuff like that, you know. I think the Predator from Predator deserves best supporting actor. You know, things of that nature. It's all Corey Haim. And did you ever see this movie called Roller Boys?
I did not see. I didn't see Roller Boys. No,
it's like a rollerblading. I don't even know how you describe it. It's like post-apocalyptic. There's a rollerblading gang, and it's like a whole. I loved it when I was a kid. It's a movie you watch when you're 10 years old, and you're like, "This is the best thing I've ever seen in my life."
Do you remember the movie Rad, the BMX movie? Do you know that
one? Yeah, of course.
Because that was one that was like, I think that was a staple of every sleepover I went to for about a 5-year period. And most people, whenever I brought that up, it's just this blank stare. Like, I was like, no, he rode his bike to the prom and he tried to take his girlfriend on the pegs. And it was a whole thing.
There was a period where they were making movies about kids riding things like the Roller Boys, Rad. The part I remember in Rad is when the guy does the backflip.
Right.
on the obstacle course. Gleaming the Cube with Christian Slater, like he's riding a skateboard in that one. It was like a whole thing, but yeah, of course I remember Rad.
Even Marty McFly at the heart of Back to the Future, the skateboard is, I mean, it's a supporting role, but the riding the thing motif and grabbing onto the back of the Jeep and all that does seem to be kind of an 80s go-to move.
Yeah, there should have been like a special Oscars category just for that.
So speaking of, I had two that, so like 1989, the 1989 movie year into the 1990 Oscars was kind of infamous for the Driving Miss Daisy win for
right.
Best Picture. Two that came to my mind, speaking of, you know, Back to the Future was, I kind of always push hard for Back to the Future 2 as well as Major League, which were both 1989 movies that would have been eligible in 1990. I don't know if you have any thoughts on either of those franchises. I mean, clearly Major League took a dip after the first installment, but that was always speaking to what you were talking about a few minutes ago of those were movies that I went to that I really loved, that I really enjoyed. They've had, especially Back to the Future 2, has had a lasting impact on the culture, but there hasn't really been a vehicle or an awards platform to recognize movies like that.
Yeah, I really like, I mean, between those two, I definitely like Major League more.
Sure.
I think Major League is one of the three actual best baseball movies. It's A League of Their Own, it's The Sandlot, and it's Major League. Those three are the ones that I think are the most enjoyable to watch. Right. Every time I say that, somebody's like, oh, what about Bull Durham or whatever? Or what about the, you know, Field of Dreams? And I'm just like, nah, wasn't what I was interested in. They're fine. They're good. Sure. Kevin Costner is one of my favorites, but those three I think are better. And with Back to the Future 2, you had some stuff that has, like, you've got those shoes that he wears,
right?
That are like $10,000, $15,000 shoes that actually exist now. You've got, you know, the dreams of the hoverboard or whatever. Back to the Future 2 is fine. Number one is really good. Aside from like you rewatch, a thing that kept happening, I'm rewatching all of these movies I watched when I was a kid, and then you see like there's some any movie that came out in the 80s, really, there's some like gnarly stuff in there.
Right. Uh-huh.
That is not like Biff.
Yes.
Sexually assaulting Marty's mom in front of Marty. And then like the whatever. There's like a lot of weird layers going on here. But yeah, I like Major League. That's my movie.
Yeah.
And Major League 2, I think, is good. They replace Wesley with Omar Epps. I think Omar Epps does a great job.
Right. There's another chapter in Movies and Other Things devoted to The Social Network and Get Out. And by the way, to people who get the book, these are two movies that absolutely clean up at the brand new Oscars. I think they go 11 for 12 between them in those categories. and I don't disagree. I love both of those movies. And you talk about them being the two best movies of the last 12 years, and you break them down by some of these career-establishing performances from the main characters and some other elements. But there's one that you mention in passing, and you talk about it's a performance of a very well-established actress, Catherine Keener, in Get Out. You don't have as much space to kind of go into that, but I'm wondering what you think makes her so powerful in her role as a sort of ringleader of a family that, and if you're listening to this and you haven't seen Get Out, this is earmuffs time, but they're lobotomizing young black people and placing the brains of old white people into, for lack of a better term, these vacated bodies then. What makes Catherine Keener, who we know from so many other things, so good in such a twisted, disturbing role?
Well, because oftentimes when you see her in movies, she's playing a similar character, similar in the like sweet presentation. This is a caring person. This is a loving person. This is a mother. This is whatever. She's like always, always endearing, always charming, always like a safe space.
Right.
And then you take that and you just flip it upside down. And she's able to do all of those same tricks to sort of lure you in. And then you find out, oh, this is the most dangerous person of the entire bunch.
Right.
And I thought that was just incredible. Even in like, she didn't even have to be a mom. Like if you look at something like A 40-Year-Old Virgin, which is just a silly movie,
mm-hmm.
with Steve Carell, and he's never had sex before. And this is the woman he's eventually going to have sex with. They fall in love. It becomes a whole thing. But even then she's just so sweet and tender in the movie and funny. And that's what you have in your head for Catherine. It would be like watching Tom Hanks play a serial killer.
Right.
Be like, what is going on? I don't understand what's happening in my brain right now. You've been conditioned to see this one person and automatically think a thing in your head, and it becomes the opposite. Like if I see Edward Norton in a heist movie, I automatically know he's the guy who's going to like double cross everyone.
Right.
It's just what his face does.
Right.
Catherine Keener is the opposite. If I see her, this is who I go to when things start to go bad and she's going to protect me. And then you find out, nope, not this time.
And you even talked about that a little bit, too, with another good example was some of the turns that Robin Williams played, like with One Hour Photo, that he's not a character that we grew up thinking like, oh, this guy can have a really sinister side to him. And it really does. I don't know. It's interesting as a movie goer to take that kind of baggage that you have with someone, good or bad, into a movie and how that can play on your reception and experience of the movie. Then.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes it's like the entire point of a movie, like with Legally Blonde, and other times it's like a little more deceptive or tricky, but all the time it's fun to watch. It's interesting to watch, especially when an actor or actress is able to like just stick the landing.
Right. I mean, do you have a sense, as someone who you don't just write about movies, but you do write about movies for a living, do you have a sense of how often that is an intentional move on the part of someone making a movie, and how often it, because I'm sure it is sometimes, but sometimes it also seems like it might be just kind of a happy coincidence that, wow, we didn't really know what we had on our hands here. Because I know that everyone knows that actors and actresses can really get pushed into certain types of roles based on a whole number of factors. And do you have a sense of how often that is the filmmaker saying like, no, I'm going to kind of put my thumb on this to really try and make a point here?
I assume whenever it happens that it's intentional.
Right.
There's just too much that goes into like writing a movie, editing a movie, all of the different like layers and parts and pieces and people involved for it to get all the way to the end. And then somebody go like, oh, I didn't even notice this was happening. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I assume the people who are making the movies are always smarter than I am. So I imagine that they're doing it each time it's happened. It's been on purpose. And sometimes it's like really obvious. Like Tarantino does it a lot where he'll take an older actor or actress and then put them in a thing and like basically jumpstart their career again. But yeah, I imagine it that more often than not, that's the reason that a person was chosen for a role or a reason a person acted the way that they did in their role.
Hey, just taking a quick break to tell you about another podcast from Notre Dame we're pretty sure you're going to enjoy. It's called Notre Dame Stories and hosted by our friend Andy Fuller. It features interviews with Notre Dame faculty making headlines, as well as stories about the life and work of the university. It's even won a Platinum Award from the Association of Marketing and Communications Professionals. You can find Notre Dame Stories wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to the show. So the illustrations in the book are by Arturo Torres, and they really are kind of a living, breathing part of the experience of reading it. One of my favorites was the two pages of the yearbook from the fictitious movie High School, where you're trying to suss out who would be in Regina George's circle of friends if she wasn't just confined to the universe of Mean Girls. I'm wondering how that process between you and Arturo works. How do you two approach what he's going to illustrate and then kind of go from there to make it be part of the book?
That's a collaborative process in that we're just like sort of texting back and forth. I'm like, hey, this is what I'm writing about. What do you feel like drawing? Sometimes he'll say, hey, well, can I see what you wrote? Maybe there's a line in there that'll jump out at me. Or we're just bouncing ideas back and forth. But for the most part, I just try to get out of his way.
Right.
When we first started working together, I was like standing over his shoulder, basically telling him, do this, do that, you know, whatever. And he can do whatever you tell him to do. It's not a problem. He's a brilliant artist. But he has a better picture in his head of what he wants to do than you're going to have. Because right. He's one of the best working illustrators in the country. So you know what it's like. Did you ever see this movie Contact with Jodie Foster?
I haven't. I've read about it and you writing about it, but I have not seen it myself. No.
Okay. In this movie, Jodie Foster is like, she studies the sky. She's a scientist and she happens across some signals that are being sent from what she assumes are aliens. And she is able to like crack the code and figures out that these are in fact alien signals. And they are sending her the blueprints to build this machine that will teleport humans from Earth to where the aliens are so that they can interact, because humans don't have the technology to do that yet.
Okay.
And they build this whole machine, and the way it's set up, it's like this gyrosphere. These like spinning rings, and a ball, a big metal ball gets dropped down through them as they spin. And it just like zoom. And while the humans are building this thing, they realize inside the ball where the human is supposed to be, there's no seat. There's nowhere to hold on. You're just supposed to stand in there. And the engineers are like, this is an awful idea. Based on all the stuff that the machine is supposed to do, you're going to get slammed against the wall and obliterated into a million pieces.
Right.
So they build a seat into it. Separate of the instructions, they're like, we're going to put this in.
Yeah.
And they put it in. Jodie Foster sits in the seat. They drop the ball. All of a sudden, there's like this violent vibration that starts happening. The seat is just going nuts. And Jodie Foster's in there. She's like, I'm going to throw up. I'm going to pass out. I think I'm going to die. This is awful. And she like starts to see whatever colors and shapes, like the transportation is happening. And she gets it in her that she's just going to unhook herself from the seat. She unhooks herself from the seat. And as soon as she does, everything is perfect. Mm. It's calm. She's just floating there. She's totally safe. And this, to me, is what it's like working with Arturo. He's going to give me some instructions. And as long as I don't try to add anything to it, it's going to turn out great. If I do, then when we have like an automatic friction involved, and it's not that great.
That's a beautiful metaphor. I like that. That's a great way to describe that. I really like the one too with the Robert De Niro on the desk, like Robin Williams from Dead Poets Society. The ones where he is kind of, it's like this mashup of different movies and different characters coming together. It's really very cool. you tell us in a footnote, and that's another thing that is really fun about this book is the footnotes, because it's kind of like at times it's this whole running narrative right below the main narrative. But you tell us in a footnote that to write the Regina George chapter, you spent something like 8 days watching every teen movie you could back to back to back. And I did something similar once with all the episodes of Seinfeld and thought I was going to destroy my marriage in the process. And I wondered if you came through that experience any better than I did. What was that like, kind of condensing teen moviedom down basically into a week plus to write that chapter?
Oh, you know, it's not bad, because in my situation, fortunately enough, like, this is what I do for a job.
Right.
This is like what I spend all of my time with. So I can go to my office and watch 5 movies in a row and then come home and everything is normal. Like, nobody at my house sees me doing the work, really.
Right.
They just know that I left.
Right.
And then I came home, and then on Friday I had a paycheck.
Right.
So they don't care. So it didn't bother too much. What does end up happening, though, is once I like immerse myself into whatever world I happen to be, I had to do the same thing with like gangster movies and heist movies and whatever, is like, it does start to shape everything else. Like, you start talking differently. when you're at lunch with your wife or with your friends, like, this is all you want to talk about. Or you're like,
right.
Oh, did you know that in 1999, it's Can't Hardly Wait? Like, you have the dumbest information in your head at the time that is like very important and valuable when you're working on the book. But as soon as you step away from the book, it becomes like, why do I need to talk about this movie from 20 years ago? Why do I need to know like the key grip from this movie was the same key grip from The Godfather or whatever? Like,
right.
You know, it's not interesting away from the book. That does happen for sure.
I took a week of vacation to try and do it, to write something that would help me make money. And it was like the perfect storm of not a good idea. I was fortunate that my best friend from college came and did it with me. It was like, yeah, my timeline on Twitter was just like the slow descent. He looked over at me at one point. He was like, dude, are you doing all right over there? Because this doesn't seem like it's going too well for you. So, but I was pleased to see. I have always probably loved Can't Hardly Wait more than a lot of, maybe than where it warrants in the teen movie universe. So I was happy to see Ethan Embry make it into the fictitious movie High School Yearbook. That was very gratifying to see him there.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was my guy. I think you and I, it sounds like you and I are probably somewhere close to the same age.
Yeah.
Similar
frames of
reference. Yeah, there was like a period in the late 90s, early 2000s where like high school movies had a resurgence.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very important to me because I was in my senior year or junior year or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to spend some time in that world again. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Speaking of, I guess, weightier performances, though, than maybe Ethan Embry and Can't Hardly Wait, you talk about, you have a chapter called Do You Think This Movie Villain Would Be a Good Hang? And again, I don't know how people don't love this book with chapters like that, but you have a line about Heath Ledger as the Joker is the single greatest acting performance that has ever happened in a superhero movie and one of the all-time great performances across all genres. And you make a point of repeating that to really drive home the point. And for people who don't remember, because it's been a little over a decade now, his performance in The Dark Knight, he died before the movie was released, posthumously won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar. And I could be remembering this wrong, but I feel like, at least at the time, there were some people that were maybe speculating, well, you know, did the real-life tragedy kind of help lead to him getting this award? You, over a decade later, talking about this performance that way, and with the benefit of time looking back at it, it really makes it clear it's just a legitimate all-time great performance. What, especially as we have a new Joker movie out now, what about Heath Ledger's Joker to you made it such a transcendent performance?
Well, I think the Joker is an important character in pop culture, just generally speaking. But all of the things that we have come to sort of associate with the Joker's existence are on display in Heath Ledger's version of it. We have no background information that's given, first of all. When Nicholson does it, you're like, oh, we see him fall into the vat of acid. The whole point of Joaquin Phoenix's Joker is to like show how he became the Joker, like whatever. But with the Joker, like, he's supposed to be scary for reasons that we don't understand, which Heath Ledger does. He's supposed to be like totally unnerving. He's supposed to be, you're supposed to like have no idea how to stop him. And all of those things Heath Ledger does in there, and he just does them pitch perfectly. He's terrifying. He is genuinely terrifying. You, any of the other Jokers, you watch Jack Nicholson, you're like, oh, he seems like he might be kind of fun to hang out with for a little while. Right. Even Jared Leto, you're like, all right, I mean, he's in good shape at least, so maybe we can go to the gym together. But Heath Ledger's Joker, you're like, I never want to be in the same room as this person because I have no idea how it ends whenever he walks into a room.
Right.
The first time we see him, he puts a bomb in a guy's mouth after killing some people that he had helped orchestrate a heist. The next time we see him, he puts a pencil through a guy's eyeball in front of a bunch of, like, it's just every single time it's bad.
Right.
And it's especially important when you look at what superhero movies have become. Mm-hmm. They've just sort of taken over everything. Heath Ledger doing what he did in that particular superhero movie. It's like, oh, we can take these very seriously. You mentioned the thing earlier about how we gave the Best Actor award to Wesley Snipes for Blade,
mm-hmm.
which is like kind of tongue in cheek, but also kind of not, because he was really the first character we saw present himself in like a serious manner in these movies. Prior to that, it was like, here's Superman and like laser beaming some food to cook faster with his eyeballs.
Right.
And then Wesley Snipes shows up and he's like, well, we can do it this other way. Like, right. those sorts of moments are important in movies, and nobody did it better than Heath Ledger in that Joker role.
And I think, you know, remembering back to that experience of seeing it, that, you know, you're right. It's just, there's something about it that not having any rhyme or reason to it just makes it so unsettling and really drives home just what, like you said, what that character is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be, oh, this thing happened and now he's angry about it. Or it's just, no, it's supposed to be absolute chaos. And this is what he is embodying, is absolute chaos. None of it makes sense. And that's why it's so villainous.
Yeah. And beyond that, like, all of this stuff is intentional. He is purposely spreading different stories about how he got the scars on his face. He's also like showing you everything with this one hand over here. He's like, oh, I don't have a plan. I'm just a dog chasing the car. I don't know what I'm going to do when I catch it.
Right.
On his other hand, he's orchestrating all of this stuff like very intentionally. It just keeps you off balance better than any villain has before or since in a superhero movie.
Yeah. So I know you're busy and you're on the run. Do you have time for one more?
Yeah, I've got time for one more.
All right. So I'd kick myself if I didn't ask you one Fast and Furious question.
All right.
You spent several pages figuring out Dom Toretto's win-loss record, and you have a line where you say, Vin Diesel is a decent actor, except for when he's allowed to emote around a car, at which point he becomes a transcendent actor. So that's part of the Fast and Furious formula.
It's Dominic Toretto at the center of it, and then also it's the interplay that he's able to have with Letty, with Brian, with the rest of his team. Like, they figured out, hey, we can like take a bunch of people, put them all together, and if they start to care about each other, genuinely treat each other like family, then it doesn't matter what else is happening in the movie, because like nobody's ever going to see a guy jump a car out of a skyscraper into another skyscraper and then do it again. Like, whatever. All of this stuff is silly, but everything at the center of it, at the core of it, this is all stuff that we sort of implicitly understand. I need to take care of the people that I care about. I need to protect them. I need to like love them and celebrate them. That's what the Fast and the Furious franchise is about. And really, whenever I was like working on the book, I was trying to pull off the same sort of trick, because I knew that there was going to be no way I could write about every movie that every person has ever cared about. It's an impossible task. So my job wasn't to do that. My job was to write past all of the movies and get to whatever feelings it is that these movies allow us to experience. That's what the Fast and the Furious franchise is doing. All of the stuff that's happening on the screen is like kind of fun and silly, sure. But really what we're looking for, the reason it's so meaningful, is when they give us those moments, like in Furious 7, when they say goodbye to Brian, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the theater is in tears. Wiz Khalifa is playing in the background. And like, why am I crying during the Wiz Khalifa song? I don't understand what's happening. But they were able to pull it all together and just really press on that button for you. And that's why it's so great. Any great franchise is able to put those same exact feelings in your chest. The Star Wars franchise does it. The Rocky franchise does it. Indiana Jones does it on occasion. Like, the ones that last are the ones that can do that. And it's why Fate of the Furious wasn't as good, or Hobbs and Shaw, which didn't have Vin Diesel in it, wasn't as good. You need that feeling at the core for it to work. Otherwise, it just becomes like a silly action movie.
I think that's a great way to end. Shay, thanks so much for making time to do this. I really appreciate it.
All right, homie. Yeah, be safe.
You take care.
With the Side of Knowledge is a production of the Office of the Provost at the University of Notre Dame. Our website is provost.nd.edu/podcast.